Hi there, and welcome to Wild Thing's second bonus episode, an interview with Peter Byrne. He's one of the Bigfoot old guard.
What they call the four horsemen of Sasquatchery, I guess is how they say it. I knew Grover, John Green, Renata Hinden. I met all of them personally. Peter Byrne, who's with us today, and the real pioneers in Bigfoot research.
Byrne's Bigfoot career started in 1960, when he was only 35. And now, at the ripe old age of 93, he's still searching for Sasquatch. He's among the last of the big Sasquatch hunters from that time. The others, a Canadian newspaper man named John Green, Renée de Hinden, a curmudgeonly Swiss immigrant, and of course, Cousin Grover, have all passed away. Only Byrne remains, and he plays the part of the dashing explorer to a T, sporting khaki safari clothes and an Indiana Jones-style hat. He drives an awesome green vintage camper van to nearby Bigfoot conferences and lives in a tiny bungalow with his wife, Kathy, on the Oregon coast. But the Bigfoot stuff is just the tip of the iceberg. And it's only one adventure in a life that's been jam-packed with them.
Well, I was born in Dublin, Ireland, in 1925. And a very fortunate thing happened to the family. My father and his brother inherited some money. So he was able to retire, and he did a marvelous thing. We moved to the country. We got out of the city, and I was brought up there from the age of five in the Irish countryside, which is rivers and lakes and forest and the outdoors, which is marvelous. And that's where I got my love of natural history and the outdoors. And I was there until I was 18. When I was 18, I joined the British Air Force, 1943, and never lived there again.
And what were you doing in the Air Force? What did you do?
I was SC Rescue, and I was an air gunner on a, we call them Catalinas. It's a big twin-engine seaplane, and all of my service was in the Indian Ocean, the islands of the Indian Ocean, and Indian Ocean is enormous. We ranged in big power boats or in the air, searching for down flyers. In nearly 4 years, we rescued 12 people, that's all. So it was rather sad. Planes crashed, the seas were alive with sharks, and so we rescued very few. We did one very interesting rescue in 1945, just as the war was coming to an end. We had a Catalina coming in from India, and it had 16 men on board. And the poor pilot, he must have been disoriented or very tired. It's a long flight. It's like an 11-hour flight. He landed the wrong way. He landed downwind and crashed right in front of us. So we went racing out there, the three of us. One of my buddies held the boat to the side of the aircraft, which had caught fire, burning horribly, very quickly. And two of us went on board, and we carried out six, horribly burned. The plane went down very quickly, and the others went down with the plane. So of the six we brought ashore, two died that night, and four survived and kept in touch for years and years and years. So in 1996, I got a letter from the Australian government. It said, we have a war heroes program, and we just found the plane in the crash of which you were involved, and we'd like to invite you and any companion you like to the Cocos Islands. So they invited, so Kathy and I went, and we spent a month as guests of the Australian government in Australia and in the islands. And they took us out to where the plane was. You could still see parts of it, only in about 30 feet of water, crystal clear water. And then we had a ceremony there, and we put flowers on the water for the men that died. Most of them were my age. They were 18, 19, 20, 21. And that's the sad part. They never saw life. They never got home. They never had families, children. That was a sad part of it. It was very nostalgic.
Are there any other stories from World War II or from your time in the Air Force that really stand out to you?
It was a Saturday morning, 44, and we were caught by surprise. We were ashore. We were playing football, about 8 or 10 of us. We had the day off. And these two bombers, fighter bombers, came out of nowhere. There must have been a Japanese carrier out there somewhere. And strafed us. They dropped four bombs. One went off maybe 150 yards from us, and four or five of us got coral shrapnel in our arms, in our faces. I got the shrapnel in my wrist and part the way up the arm here, and it began to go septic. And I jumped on a boat and went over to the main island where there was a British hospital, British Army hospital. And they put me in bed there and cleaned me up, and my arm was turning green and yellow and blue. And they said, we have a new medicine. We're going to try it on you. It's called penicillin. Well, we don't know if it works. We hope it does. I still have the arm. It was amazing, the timing.
That is amazing. I mean, that story, just like...
6 months previous, I would have had to have the arm taken off up here somewhere. I would have had to, so...
So it seems like there was something about India, about Southeast Asia, that really struck your fancy. So you went back home to Ireland, but you came back again. What was it that brought you back?
It was colonial India. And I went to see our commanding officer one morning, and I said, sir, could we take a couple of weeks off and do some traveling? And he looked at me, he said, what? A couple of weeks? What do you mean? I said, a couple of weeks, sir. He said, doesn't take a month. He said, the war's over. You've won the war. Take a month. Just come back in time to catch your ship. That's all. So we traveled a bit. I got to know India. I started to learn the language. I came home, and I was home for a couple of weeks in London looking for a job at home in Ireland. And then I turned around and went back. So I liked the country. I liked the people. Yeah, it was exotic.
So you went back to India. What did you go back to India to do?
When I was in London, I remembered that I had met two tea planters in Darjeeling. When my pal and I went up there to take a vacation, which I just told you about, and they had just come out and joined the tea industry, and they were young men. I think one was Navy, one was Air Force, and they said, it's a great life. So when I got back to London, staying at this club, I went to see the barman. I said, would you have a telephone directory? He said, yes. He gave it to me. So I wrote to 10 tea companies in London. Very simple letter. Just spent 4 years, speak the language, love the country, etc. And the 10th replied and said, come for an interview. So I went for the interview, literally got the job. And in 2 weeks, they had me on a ship going back to India. It was marvelous. I got the job. And I signed on for 4 years with the tea company. After 4 years, you got 6 months leave. And then you came back and signed on for another four. So I did 4 years, took 6 months leave, went home, came back and spent about another 3 months. That was a lovely life, great. We had cars, we had elephants to ride on. We had our own elephants.
You had your very own elephant?
Yeah.
Did it have a name?
Yes, Elizabeth. We called her Lizzie. Lovely animal, lovely old animal. And I used her for hunting mostly. Going through the jungle. The tea life is great, but I wanted to do something different. I wanted to get into big game hunting because I was doing a lot of amateur hunting at that time. So I resigned from the tea company in January 1953 and went into the country of Nepal and opened up a big game hunting company there. And I was there for 20 years. So,
could you just move there, pick up and move there?
No, Nepal was a closed country. In the country, there were two white people. There's a British ambassador and his wife. That's all in the whole country, two foreigners. Among the tea garden laborers who worked for me were Nepalese laborers. And I got to know some of them. They were different. And talked to him about hunting. And he said, there's great hunting in Nepal, especially far west Nepal. A lot of tiger, a lot of deer, crocodiles. So I had that in mind. And I met one of the Nepalese royal family in Calcutta in a bar. And he gave me his card. And he said, if ever you come to Nepal, come and see me. So I resigned, drove up to Darjeeling, sold my car, and with two Sherpas, walked to Kathmandu, about 400 miles. There were no roads, no vehicles in the country, no. And I arrived at my friend's house, and he said, what do you want? And I said, I want a hunting license. He called the principal private secretary to his house and said, fix Peter up with a permit. So he gave me a 10-year permit. So I ran ads in both of the big hunting magazines, of those Outdoor Life and Field and Stream. And a man in Los Angeles got in touch with me by letter and then by cables back and forth. And he was a safari agent. He signed up people for Africa. And he said, I like what you're offering. He said, I'm going to send you a couple. And he said, I have a good safari with you. I'll send you more. He sent me clients for 20 years. So his name is Joe Brocher. He's still living in Los Angeles and still working as a travel agent. He's 93.
And you ran this game concession for 20 years. What kind of animals were you hunting?
It was trophy hunting. And the client would tell me beforehand what he or she wanted. One might want a tiger, one might want a leopard. There are two things we didn't shoot. We never shot elephant. The elephant is a protected animal all through Asia. The elephant is one of the great Hindu gods. They call him Ganesh. And nobody ever hurts an elephant ever. So we didn't shoot elephant and we didn't shoot rhino because the rhino was a protected animal of the royal family. They like to shoot them once a year and nobody else is allowed. So those are the only two big animals. So the trophy animals my clients came for, tiger, leopard, buffalo, bison, wild boar, crocodile, five kinds of deer, and fishing and bird shooting. So mostly tiger, that was the big trophy. They came for that. So one tiger each person.
That was the limit?
It's the limit I made. No, there was no limit. You could have had five. I made a limit.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So what did you know about the Yeti? Had you heard rumors about it? Had you had a sighting, heard stories? Like where did the interest in the Yeti come from?
I heard about it for years and years. My father used to tell me bedtime stories when I was a kid. So when I was in Darjeeling in the Air Force, so I picked up a couple of Sherpas and went on a trek into the lower Himalaya looking for the Yeti, talking to Sherpas about it and where I should go, and very short, 1 week, 3 days out, up to 10,000 feet, 2 days back. So, and then when I was a tea planter, we had every year about 3 weeks local vacation. You go anywhere you want to. So I went up into the Himalaya. I couldn't go in the Nepal Himalaya, and Nepal was closed, but I could go into the Sikkim, another country called Sikkim. I went in there twice with small expeditions looking for the Yeti. And this is 1956 was one of my little Yeti expeditions. And we came out on this ridge and looked down to this valley and we saw a line of little black objects. So I said to them, what are those? And they said, those are the students of the Darjeeling Himalayan Mountaineering School and they have a camp up in that valley and there'll be some Sherpas there. So I said, let's go. So we hiked down and 2 or 3 hours later, we came into their camp. I knew some of the Sherpas, and out comes Tenzing Norgay and says, Peter, how are you? I knew Tenzing from Darjeeling from when I was a planter. We had a great dinner together. We drank some rum. I spent the night. Next morning, I'm leaving, and Tenzing walked out with me. He said, by the way, Peter, he said, I know you're very interested in the Yeti. There's a man came to see us in Darjeeling 2-3 months ago, and he left his name and address with my wife. So I get back to Darjeeling, check into the club there, and I go up to Tenzing's house to see Mrs. Tenzing. I said, do you remember this man? She said, yes, I have his name. She goes in the back room, comes out with this little bit of crumpled yellow paper, says, Tom Slick, care of the Bank of Commerce, San Antonio, Texas. And it changed my life. And told him my background. And he said, yes, I want a real search, maybe 2 or 3 years. Would you organize and put it together? I suggest. And he flew to Delhi. We met in Delhi. We did the 1 month reconnaissance together. And then from that, he started to sponsor the major expeditions, 57, 58, 59, 3 years I spent up there, coming down to Kathmandu for Christmas for a week, walking down, walking back.
So you were up in the Himalaya in the winter?
All through the winters, yes. We had good gear. And we're all young, my brother and I and the other guys with me. we first went up, and maybe the first 6 months we were living in tents. Damn cold. The wind came up, you're in a sleeping bag, the tent is frozen in the morning, solid. But where did the yak herders live? They lived in caves. So we started living in caves. And the caves are very shallow. And the yak herders have been in there for years. The ground was all black from their fires. But in a cave, you can have a fire. You can sleep around a fire. Pretty rough and pretty dirty, but it was warm. Sleeping with a fire, a lot warmer in tents.
Where were you in where exactly were you in the Himalaya?
Central and northeastern. Now, we chose this area because no one had been in there. It's very rugged. No foreigners had been in there. So, and then we'd heard stories. So we chose that area and spent 3 years there. Very rugged, very isolated.
Yeah, how did you get supplies? How did you get food? Did you have to go back out?
No, we employed men. Most of the time we had a couple of Sherpas, and their job was to hike down to lower areas and get potatoes, eggs, chickens, vegetables, fruit, apples, oranges. And they did it all the time, trekking back and forth all the time. They'd carry 80 pounds on their backs in a big basket, so we could bring in 160 pounds every time they went down. So
how long did this Yeti expedition go on for?
We spent time in Delhi. At the end, it all came to an end in December 59. And I was invited to come to America by Tom Slick. Long cables, you spent enough time up there. We like what you've done. Why don't you come over to the States and look for Bigfoot? And we said, what? What's that?
Come to the U.S. and look for Bigfoot. Had you ever heard of Bigfoot?
Never heard of it. My brother and I laughed. Yeah, we thought it was a joke. And it was a long, long cable. And we made jokes about it, which are in the book. We wonder where it is. Is it in New York? Is it climbing skyscrapers? Things like that. No idea. So I flew over here in January 1960, and I went down to Texas, stayed at Tom's house, and he pulled out the maps of the Pacific Northwest, which is about five times the size of the Himalaya. Enormous. I thought, my God. And we set up a project headquarters, a place called Willow Creek in Northern California, staff, vehicles, everything. And then Tom Slick died October 62. He was killed in an air crash, and his family shut everything down. So I went back to big game hunting in Nepal and finished hunting in the early 70s, 1970 pretty much, and then came over to the States and was contacted by a man in New York who was an associate of Tom Slick. His name is C.V. Wood. And he said, I hear there's some new footage of the Bigfoot. And he said, I'm very interested in starting up another project. So he said, would you go out and look at it? So I flew out to Washington to see it and came back and said, it looks incredibly real to me. So we started a project, another project in 71 and 72, but it lasted about 18 months. And then we found out there was some fakery going on and some things I didn't like. So I left, went down to live in Oregon.
And you never saw anything? You never caught a glimpse of anything or got anything on the cameras?
I saw footprints in that area twice, two sets, which I thought were real. One were immediately after a sighting. Both were immediately after a sighting. Good sightings, very credible.
Are you still looking?
Well, now, I and a friend here, his name is Hal Haldeman, we have cameras out. We are concentrating on the area where, in 2005, the sighting took place, and where we have found a footprint in August 2016 and August 2017, and we have cameras there, and we check them every week. We go out and spend half a day. He's working. And I don't have the energy to go out and spend days and days and days anymore. So that's about the limit of what we're doing right now.
Are you glad you've spent so much time looking for this creature, even though you haven't necessarily found anything?
It's made my life interesting. And two big projects in the 60s and in the 90s. And a lot of research and two books. They were great projects. It was fascinating. And now it's a great hobby. It's a fun hobby. And as I'm coming to the end of my writing now, this is my last book, by the way, spend more time, get more cameras out in the hope of getting a photograph of one, maybe seeing one.
Peter Byrne, Bigfoot legend. The book he mentioned, his last, is a massive autobiography, 800 action-packed pages. He told me one other story that I think you'll get a kick out of, about a Yeti hand.
We came into a big village called Pangbochi, and it had a temple, a Buddhist temple, with custodians who were Sherpas. My brother and I made camp there, and in the evening, one of them comes down, older man. So he said, "You're interested in the Yeti?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, we have a hand up in the temple here." I said, "What? What did you say?" He said, "We have a hand in a box, and it's been there 100 years. Would you like to see it?" So in the dark of night, we went up there, and I saw it. And it was a big hand, a little bigger than mine, all blackened with the oil of the lamps. So I said, "Would you sell it?" He said, "Oh, no, no, absolutely no." So I sent a runner down to the Indian border where there was a post office to handle cables for us, and he cabled Tom Slick. Tom said, "This is a great find. Come to London immediately and meet me." So I flew to London, and at a luncheon at the Regent's Park Zoo with Tom Slick and the CEO of the zoo, they call him the prosector of the zoo, and we talked about the hand. "Can you get it?" I said, "I can't get it." He said, "Could you get a piece of it?" I said, "Well, maybe." "Listen, you get a finger, cut a finger off." I said, "I'd have to replace it." So Osmond Hill, who was the prosector of the zoo, he said, "I thought of that. We brought you a hand." And he reaches under the table, brings up this brown paper sack, and drops this great big human hand on the table. He said, "Take that, cut the finger off that, replace it." Make a long story short, I did. Maybe months later, gave the lamas quite a bit of money, just taking a finger. Okay, they're all happy. Then the question came of how to get it out in Nepal. So Tom Slick sent a cable and said, "Get down to Calcutta, Grand Hotel, August or something, meet with the Mr. and Mrs. Stewart." So I walked down to 250 miles the Indian border, trained to Calcutta, went to the Grand Hotel, checked at the desk, Mr. and Mrs. Stewart, they said, "Suite number something up." So I walked up there and knocked on the door, and it's Jimmy Stewart and his wife. What's her name? Anyway, I told them what the position was, that I had the finger. They said, "We'll take it. We'll take it to London and give it to the prosector of the zoo, Osmond Hill."
Oh, so you got it out of Nepal. You had to get it out of India.
Yes. And Nepal had no postal system. And even if they had, you can't send a finger through the mail. They had no postal system at that time. So Jimmy and Gloria flew to London. So they check into the Regent's, no, into the Dorchester Hotel in London. And all their baggage is brought up to the room, and Gloria's lingerie case is missing. And she says, "Oh, God, that's where the finger is." So next day, the desk calls them and says, "There's a customs man here who wants to see you." So Jimmy says, "Send him up." So knock on the door, and this young British customs official, they thought he might have been 18. He had Gloria's lingerie case. He says, "Is this yours, madam?" And they thank him. As he's leaving, Gloria says, "I notice it's still locked." And this young man says, "Oh, a British customs official would never open a lady's lingerie case."
Lucky for you.
So they got the finger to Osmond Hill. And he had it for about a year. And he said, "I don't know what it is." He says, "It looks like a large primate, but I don't know. I still have his letter." And then he died, and it disappeared. The finger disappeared. And then about 3 years ago, I got a call from a young reporter with the BBC. And he said, "We found the finger. Would you like to come and identify it? We fly you over." So they flew me over. And there was the finger. And Osmond Hill apparently had a tiny private lab in the Royal College of Surgeons. They let him keep a little lab there. And it was in a drawer in the lab. He found it. So the BBC had it, and they did a DNA on it. And guess what they found on it? The DNA.
Yours.
Mine. Yeah. After all these years, my DNA was on it.
That story and many more are on his website, petercbyrne.com. And for more about Wild Thing, check out our website, wildthingpodcast.com. And maybe consider supporting this podcast by getting one of those super soft t-shirts or some stickers.